Hey everybody, this is Brett. Today is January 22nd, 2012. This show coming up is my recent interview on Two Beers with Steve. Fine little show that I did about 10 days ago with Steve and his co-host Chris. Real guy named Steve. And what does that mean? I always use the name Steve for hypothetical people that I create. For some reason, that's just my go-to name. I don't know what that's all about. But this was a real one, a real Steve. And I like the guy. I hope we can work together again in the future. Here's what I've done. You've heard me be interviewed before and repost those interviews here, where people's first question is, tell us about School Sucks Podcast. So I go into this speech about, oh, you know, the name School Sucks is actually quite clever because you've heard it, right? So I cut all that out. I think I cut like the first 15 minutes of the interview out right to the part where we get to some material that you haven't heard a bunch of times before on the show, I hope. It's getting to the point where it's getting a little difficult to keep track of everything we've ever talked about. And in this Two Beers with Steve interview, we actually did like a 35-minute post-show. That's going to go in the AV Club. If you don't know what that is, go to schoolsucksproject.com. Click the support drop-down menu. The first item says Join the AV Club. You're not making any kind of financial commitment. Just by pressing that Join the AV Club, it will take you to a page that explains what the AV Club is. You can read about it if you like what you hear. Then you can decide if you want to join it. Because I need antibiotics. Just kidding. Antibiotics are incredibly affordable. What I do really think I need at this point, folks. Oh, wait. I haven't even told you what's wrong with me. I went to the doctor today. The doctor took a look at me with her equipment. And she said, Brett, you have strep. I said, strep? What am I, 11? I thought that was a child's malady. No, it turns out adults get it too. So hopefully in a couple days, I will have my voice back to normal. I don't need your help raising money for antibiotics. But what I would like to do to prevent something like this happening in the future, because this is extremely painful, I would like to buy a wheatgrass farm. My new thing is wheatgrass. And that I am going to need some help with. So schoolsucksproject.com, you go to the support tab, you click join the AV Club. At least take a look at what it is. Thanks, everybody. Here's Two Beers with Steve. More shows are coming soon. Thanks for listening, and take care.
You know, I feel like we're talking about this as like people inside the school system, or like teachers, or even people that are just spectators looking at the school system. But you're telling me you have a lot of experience with children themselves that are inside the school system. And, you know, I'm many years removed from high school, and I know my experience, and you probably as well. Right, Brett? And so what are kids going through right now? I mean, what are their experiences are now, and that's different from then? Because if we have our experience and we just reflect our experiences on kids now, oh, just stick it out, you know, it's not that bad. But you have actual contact with these kids. So tell me, is there a difference between when you went to school and what the kids are going through now?
I would say that, you know, through my experiences working with and talking to kids, you know, during the breaks of these SAT classes, or I have time to work with kids one-on-one and we'll chat a little bit. And I would say some of the things they've told me have actually helped me reflect on and understand my school experience better. And one of the things that I've been saying on my show, I've said it several times in the past few months, is, you know, for me, it felt like this quiet resignation. Really in middle school, but I would say probably right through high school, of, gosh, too bad this is the way it is. You know, it would be great if things were better. And I think I was able to mine that out of my memory and say, yeah, I can relate to that sentiment, because I was hearing it from these other kids through my conversations with them. I was working with a student recently. I was brought in because he wasn't doing anything in school, wasn't handing in his work. And this is a problem. And this problem is creating a lot of turmoil in his family, between, you know, his relationship with his parents. It's creating a lot of stress for him personally. he's not interested. He's not engaged. He would rather be using that time to do other things. He has absolutely no deficits as far as intelligence is concerned. But school looms so large at that age. I think he's 15, so he's a sophomore in high school. And that really, really has a negative impact on a person's whole life, because when you're that age, school is so much of your life. And they understand that this sucks, but if they had another solution, if they said this would work better for me, I think part of that resignation is, well, like, who's going to listen to me anyway? You know, this whole system is buzzing along, and I'm told if I conform, if I fit the mold, if I'm polite, I will be invited to participate in it. You know, the same way it works with citizenship. So everything is already moving right along by the time the kids show up in this place, this building. So why would they really think that they could change anything, especially when what is woven through the whole schooling experience is this subtle but pretty consistent message of disempowerment? So that's what I've picked up in the last several years. And that was one of the things that led me to actually doing this podcast, because I realized if I said a lot of the things that were on my mind every day, I probably would have, you know, lost clients and wound up getting fired from the things I was doing. So,
so Brett, you know, knowing that we're stuck with this system that's here, what would you recommend to parents who are, you know, trying to figure out how to best educate their children who maybe don't have, for whatever reason, homeschooling isn't an option for them? What?
Oh, sure. And I know a lot of people like that. Yeah. Well, let's pick an age group.
Okay. So, I mean, right now my daughter is in second grade. So, you know, I guess early grade school or elementary school.
Okay. Can I ask why you sent her to the school that she goes to?
Well, my daughter is in, she's in a Montessori school. And, mm-hmm. you know, we looked at the schools around here. Actually, the whole way why we, you know, even started looking around is my daughter misses the cutoff for public school by, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So, and they make the test. So, if you miss the cutoff, you can take a test, but they make the test ridiculously hard, because basically my opinion is they don't want you challenging their authority. You know, we said the cutoff was this date. If you dare to challenge that, and actually, you know, instead of the cutoff being just some arbitrary date, some arbitrary age, instead of it being, I don't know, something that makes sense, like ability, you know, a maturity level.
Yep.
But if you're going to challenge that, they're going to, you know, make it difficult. I mean, basically what I heard is, 99% of people fail that test. They make it so difficult. You know, you have to really be like 1 or 2 years, you know, instead of being ready to go into kindergarten, it's, you have to be ready to go into like first or second grade to get into kindergarten early. So I, you know, me and my wife knew my daughter was, you know, at a minimum ready for kindergarten. And really she was, you know, looking at the other kids around her daycare and other kids around her age, she was advanced even for her age, you know, and it would just be really, she'd be bored out of her mind if she was held behind. So we started looking around, and we looked at the various private schools that were in our area, and I hadn't looked at alternatives at all prior to that. And I'm like, Montessori, what's this? And started I was like, you know, I fell in love with the concept when I found out about it and started researching it and went in and saw the school, and we ended up going that direction, and it's, you know, gone really well. My daughter, you know, she loves going to school. She loves it. She's like, on weekends, she's like, boy, I can't wait till Monday. She'll be sitting there. She'll say, I wonder what my teacher's doing right now. And I'm sitting there. I'm trying to like relate to that of when I was a kid. And I'm like, man, when I was outside of school, the last thing I was thinking about was what my teacher was doing. You know, and I mean, she's told me she loves her teacher. You know, she like generally loves her teacher, and she, you know, loves going at school, because, you know, and I'm sure you're familiar with Montessori. There, it's self-directed. You get to learn what you want to learn when you want to learn it. You know, so it's who wouldn't want that? I'm like,
yeah, I think that's one of the most valuable things that I would
say that a parent needs to keep an eye on if they were going to send their child at that age to a government school. Now, I guess these things could happen anywhere, but if Montessori or say a Sudbury school has this more active approach and attention paid to the self-directed process of learning, which is what education really is. You know, sit in a desk, do what everybody else is doing, follow directions, that kind of conformity, that's the opposite of education, which is why I've tried to be so much more careful about not using words like public education or the education system, because it's the opposite of what schooling is. So with that model, I would say that you have a lot less to be concerned about. But my advice to parents who have to put their kids through that system is you have to be an active player and you have to pay attention to that question. You have to be asking yourself that question frequently and you have to be making observations and coming to conclusions as to whether or not putting my child into a collective or putting my child into the system. And it's not like it's a conspiracy among the teachers and the administrators in an elementary school to crush the will and the desire to learn and the curiosity of children. It's just a bureaucracy, and that's a consequence, an unintended consequence of that kind of system. Not that plans haven't been put into it, from far away long ago, to those ends. But, you know, most of those teachers, they're trying to do their best. They care about these young people. They want to make a positive impact on their lives. But the system and the routines and the milieu of public school doesn't really allow for that, self-directed learning experience. So the parent needs to make sure, and it's different for every young child, but the parent needs to make sure that that will, that desire, that curiosity is not being crushed. They need to find ways to counteract what's happening in school, because it's going to happen in school. They need to find ways to counteract that school experience outside of school as much as they can.
And I guess give me an example of what that looks like. What has worked for other people?
Yeah, because I'm wondering the same thing when you're talking. I'm like, okay, I agree. Let me hear some examples about how that could be counteracted. All right.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that a 4, 5, or 6-year-old child absolutely loves is when an adult asks them questions, sincere questions, not like, oh, you're so cute, say something funny questions, but sincere questions that make it look like that adult has a desire to get some new information from that child. So tell me about something you know about is a great way to do that. And I mean, I guess the routine, once, you know, a kid is going into school every morning at 7:30 and coming out at 3 p.m, what would you do today? What was the best thing that happened today? What was the most exciting thing that happened today? I mean, I find I say this a lot to high school kids. When you read something, read it as if you are going to discover something in that that is so meaningful you want to share it with somebody else. So engaging kids and being inquisitive is very important. That would be one example. Certainly provide more if you want.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because with myself, you know, if I mean, I read a lot of books. I tear up a lot of books, and before I can get done with one, I've already ordered two off of Amazon to arrive at my house. It's this constant pyramid, you know, of books coming into the house. But if you had said, "Steve, you must read this," I don't think I'd ever read that. You know, I mean, there's something about being an authority figure telling you what to do. Instead, it's got to be voluntary for me. It's got to be a curiosity that I'm moving towards. And I wonder with small children. I mean, all my two kids have an insane amount of curiosity towards things around the house. But I wonder how I could stoke that curiosity in there for their school, you know, or topics that, you know, like math or something like that. But
the thing is that one of the things you said reminded me of another piece of advice I would give to parents. And this is something that I've said to my brother, who has two children, unfortunately, in these schools, is do not become the enforcers for the school. Right. Very little of what goes on in the school as far as what the demands are that are placed on the kids, the rules, the regulations, the workload, the curricula make much sense at all. So don't just automatically assume that those people know what they're talking about. And when they come to you and say, so-and-so, your son or daughter won't do this, that it is a problem with them. So don't become the school's out-of-school police, because that will really sabotage the relationship that a parent and child can have together. But, you know, the other thing about that, too, is I've had people say things to me like, I'm really worried about my son or daughter not reading or not being interested in math. And I can't say this for sure, but one of the reasons why I think that that happens is because we do just accept the school's timelines for, like, this is when this is supposed to happen for everybody, the reading, the math. So if my son or daughter is not interested in that on the school's timetable, it's problematic. When the truth is, there might just not have been that spark yet that gets them interested. And it doesn't mean that a parent can't look for ways to ignite an interest in a subject that they think their child should learn. Like, obviously, if a kid's getting to be 7 or 8 and they have no interest in reading, I think it would be perfectly normal for the parent to be looking for strategies to spark that interest up. But my advice would be, really just think carefully about how much am I succumbing to the school's timetables for these things, as far as the pressure that I'm putting on myself and maybe indirectly putting on my child to get them to learn this stuff.
Yeah. You know, we're kind of in the parenting realm right now. And, you know, I think Chris can appreciate this, because Chris has already read Parent Effectiveness Training, and I'm reading it right now. And basically it's a book. It's a little bit like unparenting, but it's, treating your child as an equal, you know, treating them as they're a worthwhile individual, that it's not an authoritarian structure that in the household, it's not a hierarchy. It's a voluntary system. So there's this sort of like feeling, you know, when we read this book, okay, how can I voluntarily manipulate my child? You know, how can I voluntarily make them do something that I want them to do? I kind of hear that when you're talking, is that, okay, how can I voluntarily manipulate my child to make them love math like I do? Because they can get straight A's so that I can feel like a great parent, so I can have a bumper sticker on the back of my my van that says, I've got a straight A student at such and such high school or middle school.
Well, this is one of the places where I think we might start to lose people as well, when we talk about parents and children being equals. Now, first of all, there are people who have these emotional barriers up, like people who didn't have very good childhoods themselves, and to avoid looking at maybe some of the trauma that they experienced or some of the mistreatment that they experienced, they basically, you know, they advocate for spanking, and they advocate for detentions, and they advocate for stricter sentences for youth. And it's like, I demand that every child, no matter how we advance as a society, or no matter how enlightened we become about how children should be treated, I demand that every child be treated as poorly as I was, so I never have to reflect upon my own childhood. I think that's more common than people think.
But it fails to understand that how you felt when you were being treated like that, you know?
Yeah. So their way of normalization of their own childhood experience would be to kind of cheer on other people treating their children just as badly in perpetuity. Now, that's one obstacle. But the other obstacle where I think we might lose people is in this characterizing, the parent and child relationship as one of equals. The truth is, and I think this should be explicated to people who are in doubt of some of these ideas, that in many ways, a parent who is, say, 35 and a child who is, say, 6, they are not equals as far as responsibility is concerned. They are not equals as far as intellect or emotional maturity is concerned. It does not mean that the child needs to be reminded of that fact every 5 minutes, you know, like I think they are in school, through the whole routine of school, that you don't know, you need our care, our supervision, our rules for your own good, constantly. The parent-child relationship doesn't have to be like that, but parents and children are not equals, but it doesn't mean that children shouldn't be treated with the greatest care and respect. I think that this whole we're not equal because I'm the adult, because I said so mentality really allows a lot of these authoritarian practices that people have been so comfortable with for so long to continue. And that needs to stop. But I think we can better explain the parent-child relationship as just one of equals.
So Brett, I just wanted to talk about that for a little bit. You know, when you say parents and children are not equal, of course you're right. No two adults are equal. Equality is a terrible – it's a really a bad way to describe what it is we're trying to talk about. There is no equality. But what you can have is respect for another person as a human being that has their own needs and their own desires.
Yes.
So that's one thing. It's more about, the methods in the parent effectiveness training. It's about treating your child with respect. And then the other thing is, too, when you said, well, your example, you know, my husband is letting our daughter run all over me because, you know, we're supposed to be equals. That's not treating those as equals. That's actually treating the child as being above the mother. If the child is really running, getting their way, they call it permissive parenting. You know, there's authoritative parenting where the parent dictates what happens, and there's an unequalness there. And there's permissive parenting, which is where the kid just gets what they want, and they're spoiled rotten, and they run all over the parents or whatever. There's an inequality there as well, and it's actually in the other direction. So that in both of those situations, there's an inequality, a lack of respect, and that's not what what good parenting should look like. That's not what good parenting looks like. It's not authoritarian. It's not permissive. It's there's a respect. You're treating the child with respect, and then you're teaching your child to respect yourself too. You're not going to let your child walk all over you, because that's going, you know, the wrong way, in the opposite direction. So say, you know, look, I'm a human being and I need to be respected too. So you have needs, I have needs. Let's sit here and come to an agreement where let's see if we can find ways where we can all be happy and get our needs met.
I'll summarize this and bring it back to schooling, because we're talking about parenting right now. We're talking about PET, and I think Chris had said it, and I'll summarize it. Is there in PET, parent effectiveness training, and it's actually chapter 11, talks about method one parenting, method two parenting, and method three parenting, where method one parenting, and this applies to to the boss employee relationship, it applies to teacher student relationship, it applies also to the parent child, and the method one is where I am the authoritarian, I'm in the position of power, I'm going to use my power. This makes the child resent the parent, or the employee resent the boss. And method two, you have where it's just the reverse, where it's permissive parenting, permissive bossing, where the employee runs all over the boss and the boss resents the employees. But method three is negotiation. You know, having this sort of common ground, you feel this way, I feel this way, let's come to an agreement that we both can work together on. And I think that's a pretty good ground to like talk about this schooling. Is there such a system in the school system, or is this sort of like the holy grail of school?
Well, yeah, I think first of all, Steve, that's a really, really good point. And resentment is a killer, and resentment can absolutely sabotage all different kinds of relationships. And we certainly see how those can exist in both cases, how that can go both ways. And I was going to say, when we use the phrase permissive parenting, well, I don't have permissive relationships as an adult, right? Where I allow people to walk all over and disrespect me. So I don't think that should be how any parent-child relationship works. So that negotiation is very important, because it teaches a mutual respect.
Right. Actually right now reading leader effectiveness training, because I'm actually an IT
manager. We're disciples.
we become Gordon disciples. Thomas Gordon wrote these books. He's got teacher effectiveness training as well. In leader effectiveness training, when he says, if you see two children playing with each other, they will negotiate over, you know, I want to play Barbies and I want to play with, and another child wants to play cars. They'll negotiate and say, okay, we'll do Barbies first and then we'll do cars or whatever. And you see two adults that are friends. I want to go to this restaurant. No, I want to go to this one. Well, they'll negotiate and come to some, two friends will come to an agreement. It doesn't have to be like, you know, I'm the adult, I'm the authority on restaurants and I say we're going here. And he says it's in situations where one side doesn't have power over the other, people naturally negotiate. We're all this method three, you know, method three parenting, this where they call it win-win situations. Instead of going win-lose, I win, you lose, there's win-win. He said, you know, when there's not one side doesn't have, when there's not a power disparity, we're really natural and we all default to negotiation. But he said this weird things happens when there isn't power disparity. People completely forget that that you have the option of negotiation. It's like, okay, now the conflict must be resolved by power. You know, and all of a sudden it's really foreign to use negotiation. You know,
when there is a power disparity,
right? And I'm not sure. I mean, I guess it all falls back to how we were raised. You know, and when we were being in our formative years. So much of us are used to the relationship with our parents being about power, but it's, you know, whenever you get in these situations where there's a power disparity, the teacher student relationship, the employee, you know, subordinate relationship, people default to using power, you know, and it's kind of a strange thing considering when the power is not there, it's so easy for us to negotiate. And then it seems so, you know, you're trying to tell an authoritative parent to negotiate with a child, you know, it seems so foreign to them, but yet they're totally willing to do it when they're trying to decide with their friends what movie they're going to go see.
And this really speaks to, you know, a lot of the problems that are often overlooked with both school and the parent-child relationship. What the two children negotiating over what to play first and two adults negotiating as to, like, where should we go to dinner – what's the common denominator there is that those relationships are voluntary, you know, and voluntary relationships are not win-lose automatically, where somebody has to be the loser, but all authoritarian relationships, and really authoritarian relationships are ultimately lose-lose, at the very least from an emotional standpoint, because everybody winds up in resentment. And I've talked to a lot of teachers in my career about what the kids in these very, very strict environments resenting the kids because of what they were getting away with, right? But obviously at the same time, the kids were incredibly resentful about the strictures that were being placed on them in that environment. So negotiation is something that people do when the relationships are voluntary. And I think that's the real trick of peaceful parenting, is that, yeah, that's not a voluntary relationship. So to understand what the attributes are, to understand what the strengths of a voluntary relationship are and how to replicate that in the parent-child relationship is very important.
Yeah, I agree. So here's an interesting question. People choose their jobs, and maybe you don't have unlimited options, but people do choose their jobs, and very, very many people are in jobs where, you know, there's an authoritarian relation style from the management.
Sure.
So, I mean, I wonder if they're, to some degree, you know, people who have been, for lack of a better word, you know, traumatized from their childhood, you know, they will often seek to replicate situations in which they're familiar with.
Well, we do what's comfortable, right? So, I mean, yes, a job, objectively speaking, is a voluntary relationship between an employer and an employee. But if you look at the things that people attach to their jobs and the amount of dependence that they have on their jobs and the, you know, the income and the standard of living and the benefits they get, yes, it is very much people doing what they've been comfortable with, replicating those more authoritarian relationships, and where they are the underling in that relationship, which is unfortunate, because again, that leads to more resentment. But this is something that really in the last couple centuries, the state has mastered, that the best way to control people, the best way to keep people loyal is to make them into dependents. So, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why people like Wes Bertrand and Stefan Molyneux have talked about the parent-child relationship, parenting so much. I mean, obviously, yes, we want young people to be free from all this terrible treatment that they've been plagued with for so long. But that really translates to a lot of these discussions that we're having about liberty as well, because if this authoritarian approach to that relationship, whether we're talking about parent-child or whether we're talking about through the education process, continues, well, by the time somebody gets to be 18, gosh, the state makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we're getting kind of down to the last couple minutes here, but I do want to end kind of like positively. You know, you've been at this for quite a while and you continue to be at it. And I want to know, like, where are some bright spots in from where you started, you know, where you're probably just kind of like the lone wolf out there. Are you starting to get a pack now? Do you have a wolf pack of school sucks people or a crowd of people who are listening to what you're saying, who have come across your message, you know, who are also equally as motivated to see some sort of change or usher in some new era of schooling?
I will say this. We have a lot of listeners there. I mean, this was a show that started very small. I was excited to get like 100 downloads in a day. We've really reached a lot of people. In the years of doing this, we've reached hundreds of thousands of people. We've had over 1 million downloads. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback. I've gotten, you know, certainly dozens and dozens of emails saying that this project has changed their lives. It's changed their approach to parenting. It's helped them look at, you know, their past in a meaningful and constructive way. That's great. I mean, I wish there were ways that I could project this message farther and louder. And part of the satisfaction for me personally, and that was really the only reason I started doing School Sucks podcast. I wasn't expecting it to lead to some kind of education revolution. And certainly, like we said right from the get-go today and like right from the get-go of episode zero of the podcast, I wasn't talking about any kind of reform effort. So I was really happy, and I got feedback that verified this, that the message that was coming from me, somebody who is usually the person who is in front of the classroom telling kids what to do, that, yeah, you're right to feel this way. You know, there are other things you can do, and don't feel defective. Don't let this beat you down. Just to be a voice, and the other voices, you know, the people who've been on the show with me and who have helped me out, communicating that same message. I'm really happy about that. And I think that this has, in that way, had a very positive mark, even if it is not reaching the number of people that I wish it could reach. But I work on that every day. So, you know, how can I get this out to more people?
Yeah. You know, I was watching a speech that you gave in New Hampshire. I think it was for the Liberty Forum. And you said something that resonated with me, and it doesn't just apply to what you're talking about. It applies to a lot of things. And that was like, you studied, you came up with an opinion, and then you went out and you went to preach to other people. And I know I'm just paraphrasing here what you're saying. I don't do it quite as well as you do, but you had this opinion and you went out and you talked to people, and people were like, you know, there's this indignation. You know, there was like this, okay, what do you believe? There was like this questioning. People were, you know, they thought you were crazy. And you asked yourself, you know, would I have retreated if I didn't have all these resources at my fingertips? If I didn't have this community of people behind me that also believe the same way, all this literature. And I think it applies to a lot of things. I thought that was really powerful when you said that, because I feel the same way. It's like, you know, I have counter culture opinions. I have things, beliefs that aren't popular, you know, among everybody, or in fact, even most people in my town or most people that I hang out with. But I still hold firm to them because I truly believe them, because I have the resources to back it up. So I thought that was powerful.
The sad thing is, and you know, on the other hand, the great thing about being alive right now and being active with these ideas, with this message right now, is think about how many people throughout history, how many young people, whether it be, you know, questions about their culture, their religion, or their government, had to suffer silently, knowing all along that something wasn't right, or this doesn't really make any sense, and why are all these people who are supposed to be older and wiser just kind of walking around pretending that this makes sense and this is who we really are? And they never really could have done anything with that. And I think in the last 10 years, what's been really powerful and inspirational, and what I'm really optimistic about, is all these outlets that have appeared. Somebody sent me a link a while ago to something called schoolsurvival.net, which is like a whole web community about, you know, getting through that high school process. I would have loved if something like that had existed, where I could take these ideas to strangers. I mean, sure, you know, you can talk about it with your small group of friends and maybe they feel the same way and maybe they don't care. But today, yes, I think it's great to have those intellectual, those emotional reinforcements that are just so readily available. And I really wish there was a way that I could help more people take advantage of more of those resources, especially when it comes to tragic bullying situation, where there are people on the internet waiting to make you feel better for free. You know, unfortunately, people are, you know, dealing with those situations in the most tragic of ways and never really reaching out, and never really connecting with a community of people who have been through the same things and feel the same way and have the same needs. So I'm, you know, whatever problems that I have with, you know, School Sucks podcast day in and day out, as far as like not having enough listeners or not having enough resources or having technical frustrations, I am really grateful that it was in this time that I was here and had these ideas and was able to project them to more people the way I've been able to do over the last few years. It's
yeah, you just got to thank those guys who are in charge of the internet.
Al Gore, thank you.
those statists, you know, those guys in government with suits on. We can thank those guys who are in charge of the internet for all of that knowledge that's been bestowed upon us. Yeah,
I'll tell you this: if those guys could have one mulligan, it would be the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless, or, yeah, I hate to end on this note, but I had this thought the other day. Uh-huh. We're going to have to end on another note because this is a really crappy thought.
It's been so positive for the past 10 minutes. So let's end on something. Yeah,
we're going to have to end it. You just give me one more positive note to end on after this. But I just had this thought the other day. Like, I'm looking at the internet. I'm looking at Facebook. I'm looking at Twitter. I'm looking at my email. I'm looking at YouTube. And I'm thinking, like, if I was the world's most evil man or part of the world's most evil clan, I would give this to the people, have them get totally dependent on it. And just at the right moment, I would pull the plug on it. It would be like the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah, cut that out of the show. That was terrible.
Because me and Chris both know it's not theoretically possible. That's why I say that.
Oh, that's good.
But, you know, all that stuff, though, is like, you know, you bring up Facebook, Twitter, stuff like that. I call that's the celebration of minutia. You know, there's just so much noise out there, but there's so much value in it too. You know, it's like, I mean, in the middle of it, there's just like, there's little, once you get tired of like, okay, I've exhausted like the dopamine in my brain. I need something that's real, that's valuable. I'm curious about this or whatever, you know? So there's so much value to it. And that's the positive note we can end on.
I'll say this, there's opportunity in all of that noise. And there is a way to make, you know, powerful personal order out of that chaos. I was talking to a kid today. He was 15 years old. He had some kind of research project to do. I said, step one, Wikipedia. I don't understand how you do not start any research project that you're assigned in school, at least on Wikipedia, saying, here's the topic. Look at the sources. What can I use for sources? How is this article written? What's the basic abstract of this topic? And all of these great opportunities that exist in all of this noise to learn information literacy. Like, the great divide for so long in history was the divide between the people who could read books and the people who couldn't. And, you know, now we're in this age where the great divide is between people who are information literate and the people who are information illiterate. And there is a beautiful, vast mainstream media empire set up to cater to the people who are information illiterate. But for those who really want to have some intellectual self-defense, the internet is a great place to learn, to strengthen that BS detector that I think we all have, but a lot of people aren't using.
Let's, you know, that we're in after hours now. So if you're listening to the regular show, forget it. You're done. It's over. But this is the after hours, because this is one of my favorite topics right here is, and it has to do with school too, is I am very positive on the future because of these kids nowadays. Like, people always talk about just how, like, they're always in, their face is always a computer, they're always in, like, wrapped up in technology and stuff like that. Oh, that kid's so antisocial, he's sitting there like on his, you know, his Facebook or Twitter. Well, you know, when you were a kid, you could only talk with like two or two kids at once. These kids are talking with like 40 kids at once, you know, who knows what they're talking about. But the way they're you know, they're adapting to this technology, it just blows my mind. And I think it would be very difficult to be a status quo teacher to these students who teaches out of a textbook. You cannot. They're smarter than you. They're faster than you. They're better than you. I mean, they speak this as a language. Like, we had to learn – I had to learn the internet. They speak it as a language. They're fluent in it. And the way they adopt this is just incredible. Like, they know no boundaries. When they see a problem, you know, most people turn to their friends. If you're like 45, you turn to your buddy who's a plumber. They turn to the internet, right? Like, right away. Like, you're talking about, to like turn to Wikipedia and stuff like that. So, you know, no one can foresee how we're going to use a technology like the vehicles. I know this is kind of a long thing here, but, you know, with vehicles, they first look like stagecoaches because that's what people thought they were, you know, like they were stagecoaches with engines on them, you know, take away the horse, put an engine. But look how cars have evolved from looking like stagecoaches to what they look like now. We've sort of evolved. We've sort of adapted. We evolve and we adapt faster. So I'm really positive on what these kids are going to do with the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm always like, kind of make a fool out of myself when I'm working with kids and I say, watch what I know how to do on the computer. <You know? laughs> and they're like just so far ahead of me. I had this experience with another kid recently where he had to make like a trifold brochure. And I was all excited about like, all right, let's use Photoshop. And he could just do it like twice as fast as I could, like almost like it was just instinctive for him. I mean, he just had always been surrounded with that and just grew up with that. Maybe even if he didn't know exactly how to do what I was trying to show him to do, he learned it so much faster than I had learned it. So I mean, it is exciting. And criticisms that adults have about how kids use technology, in 1986 Reggie and I had to stand there and bounce a ball back and forth, you know, out in the street. And maybe we had a nice friendship, but the way kids are networked today, I think a lot of people just don't understand it. They're unfamiliar with it. They don't know how to use that technology. And that kind of just leads to, again, another resentment. But from what I've seen, from what I've been involved in the last few years, I'm really excited about what I've seen kids being able to do with the technology that's available to them today.
Yeah. Now, that's a positive note.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, one more quick thing before we end today. I was recently on an episode of Sex, Lies, and Anarchy podcast. Corey and I were just for like the last third of the show. They were doing a show about hugging. Corey and I happened to be in the studio, and they invited us in for the last segment just to discuss our thoughts on the topic of hugging. So if you want to check that out, go to sexliesanarchy.com. You can download the episode there. The host of the show, Antigone and Celestina, had Matt on with them. Matt, you know from our Clockwork Orange show. And then Corey and I jumped on mics as well. So this is some strong language adult content. Strong language adult content. If you are offended by that, you can stop right here. The show is over. This is just a 2-minute preview of our contribution to the show, which I think was a valuable one because I provided a pretty important public service announcement. But strong language, beware. Thanks for listening. talk to you soon.
He keeps it tight. Why can't you tell that to him without it being awkward?
Brad, why can't a heterosexual guy tell another heterosexual guy that he thinks his booty is fly?
Exactly. Well, that's the issue. That's what it comes down to.
I can't tell if Brett is blushing right now, but it sounded like his response was thank you.
Yes, thank you.
That's the only response you can give when a man tells another man that his booty is fly.
It's the only appropriate response.
True.
Just unless, learn to take a compliment, guys. Really.
Exactly. I know.
Full disclosure, though, I haven't been exercising that much, and I've grown a terrible pair of tits. But thank you anyway.
See, that's why I should hug Brett, because I like tits.
Yeah, he did mention earlier that, you know, when he hugs a girl, all he's thinking is boobies.
Boobs.
I've tried to warn girls about that with these guy huggers that show up out of nowhere for hugs. Right. And it's always like they go in and they do the hug. Right. And then they do kind of the
like rub your
medium
chest
shot assessment while they're still having their hands here. And they just get a little bit of side boob with their palms on the way out.
Mm-hmm.
I know what you're talking about. I mean,
that gets someone punched in the dick.
These guys.
That's very different from the please don't feel my boner hug.
This works like the pickpocket. Right. When someone bumps into you, you don't feel your wallet slide out of your pants. So the side boob palming happens when they're saying something that diverts the attention somewhere else. This happens.
It's all misdirection.
Where you side boob palm with one hand and yank her pants off with another hand.
Exactly.
You don't feel that because there's a bump.
So basically you guys are going to make like all women uncomfortable with hugging their dude friends.
Watch out for these side boob palmers.
This show has single-handedly destroyed hugging for all people for the end of time. No one's ever going to hug anyone again before we're done.